Thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. The Trump administration's campaign against diversity, equity, and inclusion is now aimed at college campuses, and some local universities are the target. And what the future of police reform looks like after a leadership change at an agency tasked with investigating officer misconduct. Now to some of today's top stories. Mayor Brandon Johnson met this afternoon with top education leaders amid fears of a possible teacher strike as negotiations over a new contract drag on. The mayor summoned key players to his office, including fired Chicago Public Schools CEO Pedro Martinez, Chicago Teachers Union President Stacey Davis Gates, and school board president, in an attempt to help broker an agreement. Afterwards, the mayor told reporters, quote, "The goal of this meeting was to open up the conversation to look for potential compromise or compromises to avert a work stoppage, to keep kids in the classroom. There's no reason for any of these outcomes when we are so close to landing a deal." It goes on to say none of these issues that they need to settle will be worth the consequence of 6-7 days or however many days out of school. Governor J.B. Pritzker says federal spending cuts could leave Illinois $11 billion worse off, and that the state would not be able to make up that shortfall.
What we're talking about across the board, health care, education cuts, et cetera, that we don't have what right now looks like about $11 billion that we will lose. We don't have $11 billion to fill in the gaps on education, healthcare you're talking about. In a world where we've got to worry about keeping our rural hospitals open when we lose, if we lose what I think we may in Medicaid, we've got to, it's going to be triage.
Pritzker made the comments at a roundtable discussion this afternoon with agricultural leaders in Illinois. Last week, Pritzker said cuts to the U.S. Department of Education could cost the state as much as $3 billion. And Illinois Senator Dick Durbin is sounding the alarm over staff cuts at the Department of Homeland Security. Durbin, along with Michigan Senator Gary Peters, are demanding the department halt plans to reduce staffing or eliminate its civil rights and civil liberties offices. In a letter to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, Durbin and Peters write, "A decision to eliminate the Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Office or make significant reductions in CRCL staff will jeopardize DHS's ability to comply with statutory requirements and to protect the civil rights and civil liberties of the American people." The letter follows an executive order issued by President Donald Trump last month, directing federal agencies to prepare for large-scale layoffs. Up next, what the future of police reform might look like after a leadership shakeup at the Civilian Office of Police Accountability.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
The agency charged with investigating Chicago police misconduct is getting new leadership. It comes as Andrea Kirsten, the former leader of the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, or COPA, has resigned. The move happened after the city's police oversight board, the Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability, issued a letter to Kirsten saying they were planning to take a vote of no confidence in her leadership. The office says it identified, quote, critical failures of leadership that seriously undermine the quality and integrity of COPA's work. Kirsten slammed the allegations as unfair and unfounded. Joining us now are Anthony Driver, president of the Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability, and Ramel Terry, the commission's vice president. Welcome back to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Anthony, let's start with you, please. Should Chicagoans be concerned that the city's police accountability system has failed?
Well, I think Chicagoans should know that we're doing our job. It's actually working. The commission, when it was created, was tasked with overseeing the police board, COPA, as well as the Chicago Police Department. So we're doing our jobs. Chicagoans should know that, you know, we're behind the wheel and we're going to make sure we get this right.
What more do you think could have been done to improve some of the concerns that you had at COPA before coming to the point of a no confidence vote?
Well, I wouldn't say that things could have been done to improve it. The thing is that there were employees who worked for COPA who decided to come forward with complaints to our commission We heard them out. We thought that some of them are valid, and we were moving in that direction. We did not take a vote of no confidence, Chief Administrator Kirsten. You know, she resigned. And so now our task is to find the right person to lead the agency in the future.
Ramel Terry, how would you describe the working relationship between your agency, CCPSA, and COPA?
Well, I think that we have a very good relationship in terms of the fact that the employees there felt comfortable enough to come forward and speak to us. I think that says a lot, especially with a lot of the things that we learned in our process of having these conversations with the employees who came forth, as well as with Chief Kirsten. So I think we are excited about an opportunity to have new leadership, one that we can be very clear about the expectations that they will be held to, and that this commission will not take our eye off the prize in terms of holding people accountable, no matter which role they serve in.
Just so our viewers know, what were some of the complaints that those employees came to you with?
There were concerns related to having information around patterns and practice investigations that were not sort of moved forward within the department, which is a big responsibility of the department. There were also concerns about, you know, failures to hold people accountable when actions were taken. And even in conversation, we learned that some of that has been corroborated. So we were very intentional in not just hearing things, but ensuring that we had everyone weigh in on their positions and made a decision from there.
Your letter, it criticized public statements that former COPA leadership made about pending investigations, specifically the Dexter Reed shooting. What was said that the commission considered crossing the line?
Well, I'll take that one.
Sure.
I think there was information that was put out that was presented as facts. You know, there's no way to know that. There were five people on the scene that day, five officers who stopped Dexter Reed, and obviously Dexter Reed himself who was present. Those are the only people who can say definitively why they pulled him over. If you hear that from someone else that wasn't on the scene, who may have come later, even if it's true, even if it's something that you heard from somebody else, it's hearsay. And so until you can verify that, we believe that that's not something that should have been put forward unless that was verified by someone who was on the scene.
Okay, so Andrea Kirsten, she also sent a response letter claiming that she believes that she was treated unfairly. It reads in part, quote, "Now that a chief administrator has finally begun fulfilling these mandates that became enshrined in the consent decree to do the hard things that the city asked of it, CCPSA has apparently decided that it wishes that COPA and the city's accountability system retreat from this reform pathway. CCPSA has rendered one of the hardest jobs in the city, in city government, even more difficult." Anthony, what's your response to that?
You know, I respect Chief Administrator Kirsten and her opinion. I just think it's patently false. It's not true. We are a commission that was birthed to have accountability. And unless, you know, the officers who are going through this process believe that the process is fair, and the citizens need to know that if an officer is doing something wrong, they will be taken off the street. That is our responsibility. These are not all pro-accountability folks or all anti-police folks. It's a multitude of folks. Over 10% of the workforce at the Civilian Office of Police Accountability came forward with allegations, and they were heard. If that's the case, you know, I would ask her why the people that you promoted multiple times, people who were in your inner circle, people who you hired, why did they feel the need to come forward if everything was going so well?
And to be clear, you just said that 10% of the staff
more.
At the more than 10% of the
Correct.
Staff at the agency had complaints about leadership.
Correct.
Yes.
And initially there was only a few folks, and we referred that to the Inspector General. That's the body that this is appropriately handled at, because they are the fact-finding agency of the City of Chicago. What happened was, after two people who were whistleblowers were fired, after coming forward, it created an avalanche where more and more and more people started to come forward with their stories.
Last October, our team reported that COPA found a pattern of undocumented aggressive traffic stops on the city's west side a year before the Dexter Reed shooting that we've already discussed, but took no action. If the chief administrator had done her job differently at the time, would Reed still be alive? Had a flag been raised?
Well, We can't predict the future or what would actually occur, but it would be good to know that was actually being, you know, taken, action was being taken on that sort of scenario, right? Because that's serious information that should have been moved forward, that we eventually learned was not just with that particular police district, but other tactical teams, and no action had been taken. And so those are significant concerns for us.
And it really hinders the entire accountability system. Mm-hmm. If you know something is wrong, or you have an inkling that something is wrong, and you're the oversight agency, you have a responsibility mm-hmm. to bring that forward. Had that come forward, we can't say whether or not Mr. Reed would have still be would still be here with us today. But had the agency come forward with these complaints, we would have then been able to do our job to hold the superintendent and the police department accountable. You can't do that if they don't have any knowledge of what's happened.
Anthony, what did you learn about how the city's police accountability system is functioning based on your examination of Kirsten's tenure there?
Well, I think there's a lot of checks and balances, right? And so that's essentially what the CCPSA is. We are a body that oversees three different agencies within the city. There's a multitude of agencies in the city of Chicago, and some people will call that convoluted, but I think this is an instance where it actually shows that the process is working, where if one thing fails, there's a fail-safe to make sure that that can be corrected.
You also say the problem is not just COPA leadership, but also systematic problems. What else do you think needs to be corrected?
Well those comments were in regards to the consent decree specifically, but this is not, you know, as I said before, the Chicago Police Department is not in the consent decree. The city of Chicago is in the consent decree. That means the mayor's office, human resources, the commission, COPA, the OIG, OPSA, I can keep going down the line. All of those folks are responsible for ensuring the consent decree is carried out. And thus far, the narrative has only been on the Chicago Police Department. And I'm okay with that, but I will say, until the city of Chicago and all of the entities that support it buys into the consent decree, we'll never come from under it.
City data, Rommel, shows that taxpayers spent at least $107 million to resolve lawsuits alleging Chicago police misconduct in 2024, 43% more than in 2023. Do you think your office is doing enough to reduce police misconduct, which would then reduce the cost to taxpayers?
I think that we're on a path to address all of these concerns. As President Driver has pointed out, right, we are still a fairly new commission, and I think that we've had a lot of success. We are very proud of the selection of Superintendent Snelling. We do stand behind a lot of the initiatives that he is implementing, and I do believe that we'll see a change in the tide and a lot of the concerns. But those things take time. So if there's an expectation that overnight we're going to see a significant decrease, we would all love that. That's what we're pushing for. However, we understand that slow drips can, you know, create a waterfall.
And I'll also add, there's a lag, right? So these cases that are being heard predate, these settlements that are happening now, they all predate our commission.
Yes.
Before we were even, you know, in existence.
And speaking of timing, and we're almost out of it, but what is the timeline for finding the new leader of COPA?
So we're in the process of developing that now and hiring a search firm, but our internal goal and what we will say is that we're hoping to have this wrapped up in 6 months.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Rommel Terry, Anthony Driver, both of CCPSA. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're back right after this. Three Illinois universities are facing federal investigations over diversity, equity, and inclusion programming. It comes as the U.S. Education Department in February issued a letter instructing educational institutions to stop, quote, using race in decisions pertaining to admissions, hiring, promotion, compensation, financial aid, scholarships, prizes, administrative support, discipline, housing, graduation ceremonies, and all other aspects of student, academic, and campus life. If they don't adhere, those universities risk losing federal funding. Joining us to discuss more are Xavier Ramey, CEO of Justice Informed, a social impact consulting firm. And via Zoom, we have Jacob Hubert, president of the Liberty Justice Center, a not-for-profit litigation firm. Gentlemen, welcome back. Glad we can regenerate the conversation.
Yes.
So as we mentioned, the University of Chicago is among nearly 50 other institutions under investigation for alleged racial discrimination related to DEI programs, namely the college's partnership with something called the PhD Project. It's a nonprofit that aims to increase diversity in the business world. Jacob, going to start with you, please. Under these new federal guidelines, is this practice illegal?
Well, I can't, you know, as a lawyer, I have to be very careful. I don't know all the specific facts of the case, but I do know that there are programs in private and government universities across the country that do discriminate based on race, that do give out money, give out positions based on race. And the law has always said that that's illegal. And President Trump has made clear that he's going to enforce that law by denying federal funding to institutions that engage in this kind of discrimination. So if they find that this is going on, then I expect they will cut funds and they'll be right to do so.
I'm going to come back to the funding argument in just a bit as well. But Xavier, we know that you're a proponent of DEI initiatives. Of course, it is your work. What are the consequences of dissolving programs like the PhD Project?
We go back to the United States that was in existence pre-1964 in the Civil Rights Act. This is an attack on creating equality in America. The reality is the reason why these programs exist, and I want to just really anchor on the fact that we need to be very specific about what we mean when we say discrimination. These are programs that support disadvantaged persons to create pathways for them into institutions that historically have had no way to actually engage them relative to the issues that they have in their lives outside of campus or the workplace. And so this is these are strategies to support people who have not had the ability to enter in. And I think that we need more of this. If we don't have these types of programs in place, these universities and institutions do not actually have strategies that can deal with the societal effects of racism, sexism, gender inequality that keep women out of university and academic programs, or black folks and brown folks. They don't have strategies in place to ensure equality of outcome. And these programs are there to create an opportunity of input to create more of an equality of outcome.
So similarly, Northwestern University and Illinois Wesleyan University are among institutions that received a letter outlining potential Title VI violations, failing to protect Jewish students from anti-Semitic harassment and discrimination. And of course, that notice, it follows pro-Palestinian rallies on college campuses, and the Trump administration remains aligned with Israel. Xavier, is this move political, or is this a true act of solidarity for Jewish communities?
I can't answer whether it's political. I can say it's one-sided. The reality is they're not speaking on behalf of the issues of Islamophobia. I am someone who believes very strongly that we should not have any tolerance for anti-Semitism. And I believe in the responsibility of our country to make sure that its Jewish citizens are protected. And at the same time, we understand that our Muslim students and Palestinian students, particularly on these major campuses, have not been safe. They do not have programs or curriculum that is specifically there to educate people about Palestine, its history, or otherwise. And the rescinding of these programs, support or otherwise, and to have a one-sided situation where we're just talking about the experience that Jewish students are having on campus is fundamentally one-sided. And I think we need to be they need to be even balanced in this.
Jacob, former Columbia University graduate student and lawful permanent resident Mahmoud Khalil was arrested by immigration authorities and is at risk of deportation for what some are saying is punishment for his outspoken pro-Palestinian stance. Is this setting a dangerous precedent that if you don't align with the president's personal ideologies that you are at risk of deportation?
Well, I can't speak to the facts of that case. I don't know specifically what this person did and didn't do, but certainly it would be disturbing for the president to be targeting people for legal consequences based on what they say, based on their political opinions. A lot of people supported this president because they believed that he would be restoring free speech after it was under attack for so many years. So it would be concerning if you're targeting students, immigrants, whoever, based on political opinions alone. Now, if you're talking about association with terrorist organizations or real support for terrorist organizations, that would be another story. But if it's just about speech, that is something to be concerned about.
Jacob, you mentioned this earlier, that universities that don't adhere to the federal guidelines are at risk of losing federal funding. Is that a fair punishment?
Definitely, because that's one of the conditions of taking federal funding, is that you're going to comply with federal law. Now, of course, when you're talking about government institutions, when you're talking about state universities, they have to follow the Constitution and the law anyway. They are, just from that alone, they shouldn't be treating people differently based on race or sex. And so they should have serious legal consequences just based on that. But even these private schools, when they take the federal money, it comes with these strings attached. And if they want that money, it makes sense that they would comply, particularly when we're talking about these rules that just require them to follow basic American values of treating people equally and not treating people favorably or disfavorably based on their race.
Xavier, is pulling federal funding a reasonable response to this issue, to not to operating a DEI program?
No. Very simply, no, it's not. And one of the things that is happening right now, as we're seeing, is President Trump is continually in court for these executive orders and these directives. Much of the language is vague, including the language that was sent to the universities. The language in the DEIA executive order has been contested by courts. The language in his obstruction of funding to USAID has been contended in court. He's lost a lot of these battles already. And the challenge is that in between that time, when funds are not being provided, we are losing incredible supportive services for people who truly do need those funds for their education, for their housing, for their social services, etc. And he's playing this war of attrition right now, where it's more ask for forgiveness, not permission.
Jacob, you argue that institutions should be able to help level the playing field for students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. How do you differentiate that from a diversity, equity, and inclusion initiative?
Well, I don't know about leveling the playing field, but certainly schools absolutely are able to do things to attract and support students who come from a disadvantaged background, who grew up without a lot of money or in inferior schools or far away from cities and those resources. Of course, it's fine to support students who are disadvantaged, whether it's financially or otherwise. But what's not okay under the Constitution and under federal law is to, again, treat people better or worse based on their race. Nobody is saying that schools can't help give help to people who need help. But what they are saying is that the criterion cannot be race.
Xavier, is that enough? Why isn't that enough for the criteria to be basically socioeconomic background, helping those who come from maybe low-income, first-gen families?
When you look at the black population in America, the majority is experiencing economic hardship in ways that the white population is not. When you look at the Latino population in America, the Latino population is experiencing economic hardship in ways that white populations are not. The reality is that where Jacob is saying that, you know, we should have programs for disadvantaged people, the reality is that in America, that is also something you can track by race. And when we're talking about creating programs and projects and support, financial or otherwise, this isn't to create a preference. This is to create support in a specific way. There's no point in giving at the University of Chicago, for example, to where the average white student who is admitted into the University of Chicago is coming from a significantly different economic class than the majority of black students and brown students. There is no reason to create programs that they can tap into for financial support when their families don't need it. What they're asking for is that people who don't need support get access to support, and the people that truly do need it, because they're black or because they're brown, that they don't deserve to get that specifically, because that feels like discrimination when it's actually just specific support.
Could this issue, Xavier, and then I want to get your thoughts on it as well, Jacob, could this eventually impact historically black colleges and universities, women-only institutions?
Of course. All of these, the women-only institutions, predominantly black institutions, HBCUs, those were all created to deal with what was happening because of the legacy of chattel slavery, because of racial capitalism, and because of white supremacy that was in existence by law up until 1965. These programs were not created to create some racial preference out of nowhere. They were created because real harms were happening, and the effect of those harms was racially specific or gender specific. And these programs that are being pulled back out of the guise of somehow it's doing harm against persons who don't need support and who have never experienced racialized harm, it's a simple bait and switch, and it's disingenuous at best, but it is harmful and absolutely will have an effect on our HBCUs and on populations of women. I expect that we're not going to see as many women in PhD programs. I expect that we're going to see less black people and brown people going into those programs. And here's what we know about PhD programs. When you bring persons with minoritized identities into these programs, they study the experience they had in America, and we get more clear on what experiences they've specifically been having that other folks who have a majority experience don't have. And that allows us to be more accurate in our ability to attend to them in medical institutions, or to support them in small business programs, or to ensure that their children can survive, or that black mothers can survive when they're having babies, because we know that they die more often than white women. So why would you create programs for white women when they have better outcomes already?
Jacob, same question to you.
When it comes to the HBCUs, of course, they don't actually discriminate based on race now, at least. I mean, they don't exclude white people or Asians or any other group. And as a result, you do have people of different backgrounds attending those schools. And I expect that you will continue to have people of different backgrounds attending those schools, and people who like the traditions of those schools will be drawn to those schools. And so you don't need any sort of There's nothing in the prohibition of race discrimination that would stop these schools from doing what they've always done. Again, what this targets is excluding or including people simply based on their race. The Constitution says that's illegal. Federal law says that's illegal. The Supreme Court has said illegal. And that's all we're talking about here. There are many, many ways to help disadvantage people of various backgrounds. And if more people in certain minority groups are suffering more, then that, of course, means that they would be more likely to take advantage of any such programs. But the programs don't have to be based around race. And under the law, they cannot be based around race.
All right. Thank you so much. That's where we're going to have to leave it. I'm glad we were able to do part two, part three in the future. I'm sure Xavier Ramey and Jacob Hubert, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this Wednesday night. Please be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Chicago school board members are expected to vote on a budget amendment to cover a $175 million pension payment. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to be a multilingual law firm that provides translators for a variety of languages.